Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, anyone in between and all those still trying to figure it the fuck out, please sit back, relax, put in your earphones, and buckle your seatbelts. The next 2 hours are guaranteed to not be safe for work. Now welcome to your speakers, smartphones, or laptop, America's sweetheart, Pollo Del Mar, and a San Francisco's blazing beauty, Pearl Tees. It's time for Podomatic's number one ranked LGBT podcast, and 120 minutes of your life you will never get back. Brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, it's time for Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Party Foul Radio. I'm your co-host, Ms. Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Tees.
This is episode 84, and it is going to be jam-packed for you guys. We've got interview after interview after interview, huge name celebrities, and we are very excited to be coming to you just a few days after the Design Meets Divas of Drag, where Pearl and I went head-to-head in competition.
And both lost.
But I will tell you this, we both look gorgeous.
Yeah, girl,
you looked stunning. You really did. Your outfit was gorgeous.
It was amazing. The designer,
Kipper?
The designer of the fabric saw the outfit that Kipper made me, and she just fell in love with it and took all these pictures. And
the designer or the actual designer of the fabric. That is fucking bomb, bitch. Good for you.
So hopefully something comes from that. We've connected and stuff, and we'll see where that goes. But she loves it. I really hope to be able to do it again next year, so I can have just the opportunity to do it again. It was a blast.
It really was. It was. I will say this. I've done this. This is my third year doing Design Meets Divas of Drag, and it was by far my favorite outfit that I've had. And I turned out to like both of the previous outfits very much, but this one was my favorite outfit. So congratulations to our designer. Pearl and I had the same designer, like the clothing designer, Kip Yanaga, or Kipper Snacks. And she was able to bring my vision for this outfit absolutely to life. Her work was impeccable. She made me this jacket that was so beautiful that people didn't even realize it was made from fabric that we had gotten from the designer. It looked like it was like off a high-end rack, somewhere. It was so beautiful. And Needle for Cher, who was my design firm, the company through which we got our fabric, was so beyond excited about what we were able to do. Stacy at Needle for Cher and all the people at Needle for Cher, thank you so much. Terry McLaughlin, thank you for pairing me up with this such an incredible and supportive company. They were just beyond. You know, that's the one thing I think that's really wonderful about this is that when these studios... So what happens, if you're not familiar, if you haven't been listening to previous episodes, is that they pair us up with...
A showroom
that provides, generally speaking, fabrics for interior design efforts. Yeah, things that would go towards, like...
Upholstery fabric, pretty much.
Upholstery or drapery or sofa, that kind of stuff. And then we make these couture outfits out of them, and people, you know, it shows that these fabrics are more versatile than people would imagine. Well, this year I was beyond pleased with my showroom. Thank you, Needle for Cher. Thank you, Terry. We hope that we will both be invited back next year.
Right. I think, well, they loved what I had, so hopefully, fingers crossed, I'll be
right
back.
And congratulations to the three people who won. The winner, of course, was Vanity Eatonov, her performance was sickening. Her outfit was beyond sickening.
Runner-ups, Roxy Cotton Candy.
My sister Roxy Cotton Candy came in first runner-up.
And the fabulous Honey Mahogany right after her. She was so amazing. That girl's voice gives me chills every time I hear it.
So, Honey Mahogany, I don't know who was designing for Honey. I do know that Landa Lakes, my drag mother, Roxy's drag mother, was designing for Roxy, but I don't know who designed for Honey, and I don't know who designed for Vanity.
Have no idea.
So, anyway, but congratulations to all the contestants in Design Meets Divas of Drag. Mm-hmm. That was wonderful. Then, what Did you spend the rest of your weekend just sort of laying low?
So that was Friday.
It was Friday. Oh, congratulations. Afterwards, I went over to the Lookout for the 10-year anniversary of Lookout. Congratulations to Greg Crosby, the manager of Lookout, Chris Hastings, the owner of Lookout, and all of my friends who have been at Lookout. Lookout has been so...
Yeah, a lot of people went over there right after the
yes,
event.
Yes, they did. I saw Camara Rouge there.
Was it a pretty packed...
It was. Well, it was starting to thin out a little bit by the time we got there at like 10-something. You know,
okay.
But Camara Rouge was there. I saw Paju Monroe. Mercedes Monroe was there. Lots of people just partying, whooping up, having a good time. The Lookout has such a warm place in my heart because of the fact that they were the first ones to actually hire me to do something, uh-huh. You know, as like on an ongoing basis. And they've been so supportive. And you guys, through their charitable efforts, they've raised over $1 million, well over $1 million in the last 10 years for causes relating to the community. So mm-hmm. Congratulations to Lookout. To not only being such a fun place to go and spend your time, but also such a giving place to go. It makes you feel a lot better knowing that some of your funds that you're doing and the fun you're having go right back into the community. So Thank you.
After the show at the San Francisco Design Center, me and my drag sister Tiny and my little brother Joseph went to...
Her brother Joseph just could not keep his hands off me. So unnerving.
In her dreams. In her wildest dreams, girl. So we went over to... and one of my dancers went over to Nightcap, which is right underneath our designer's house, and had drinks with our designer. And
oh, that's
out.
Right. I was like, where the hell is Nightcap?
Yeah. And hung out with our designer and celebrated my little brother's birthday because it was actually his birthday that night.
Shit, so I forgot.
That was...
I should have given him a blowjob, you know, just as a gift.
I think he's got that covered.
he ain't never had my blowjob.
I don't think he wants. I don't know who would want that, girl. You have no teeth, a new meaning, I'm sure.
Whatever, but bitch. Anyway. I got perfect teeth. Thank you very much, you sniz.
Anyway, so it was lovely. Like, it was nice to be able to hang out with Kipper outside of work, and because everybody in the city knows she's always at that sewing machine. So it was.
She really is.
And then after that, the only thing else I really did this weekend is I had a little date on Saturday, which went fabulous. But other than that, I stayed away from, like, the drag queens and all that stuff. I kept it pretty low.
Well, you guys have heard Pearl incessantly nagging me and bitching at me about dating or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Wait for it.
You did not. Did you really?
No.
Finally.
Wait, hold on. No. Listen, bitch. Listen. And you will now know why I fucking tiptoe so lightly around dating. So, Saturday, I worked all weekend. So, I did 2 gigs Friday. Saturday night, I was out campaigning for Miss Shogunna in the Castro for Grand Ducal Council.
That's volunteering.
Right. Yeah. And then I went immediately from there to do the Bachelorette show.
Oh, fine.
At Divas Royale. And then the next morning, I woke up to speak with Elizabeth Shue, the Oscar-nominated actress, who you will hear our interview later in this podcast, and then head to Sacramento, because I was in Sacramento with Malay Balenciaga and all the girls of Sacramento on Sunday night. So it was jam-packed. But Saturday evening, I went on one of the, like, you know, the apps. And I saw
that... What app?
Jacked. I was on Jacked. So I went on Jacked, and I saw that I had a message. So it was a gentleman... 55 years old, very handsome.
All right, so up your age range.
Like a little, quite a bit older than me, but...
Just a little bit,
10
girl.
Years is a little bit older.
Like three to five.
Whatever. So he was handsome. He says, hi, you're gorgeous. Gives me his phone number. So instead of messaging him on this app at like 11 o'clock at night, I just sent him a text message. Didn't think anything of it. Sent him a text message.
Off the first message?
Yeah, why not? Like...
Okay.
Because of the fact that... I figure I can just fucking disassociate just as easily from a phone number. I mean, granted, they have your phone number, which actually, you guys, Pearl being skeptical like that will play definitely into the rest of the story because she's actually...
Correct.
Correct.
Like usual.
She's smart. So, not in general, but in this case, she's smart. So we're texting back and forth, and I'm bouncing this. I'm going to tell the story. Pearl's never heard this. I'm going to, like, get some feedback from her, too, because this is so unbelievable what happened. So we text a little bit back and forth, and he says that he's in town every single month on business, And then he says, oh, I'm staying in Burlingame. My hotel is in Burlingame. Where are you located? I told him where I'm located. He's like, how far is that? When somebody says, how far am I from you? Like, doesn't that imply sort of almost a, like, is it too far to, like...
Not necessarily. Not necessarily.
Okay. But it's sort of a... But there's a potential possibility that it could be taken that way, right?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. So, I said to him, like, really, like, upfront, look, I'm not... If you're looking for a hookup type thing, I'm not interested, not doing it. I'm not coming to somebody's hotel room or whatever. Just on the off chance that's where you're going with this. It's not going to happen. It's 1 o'clock in the morning at this point.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I had to be up early in the morning. Well, he seemed okay with that. Like, message me after your interview. So, get up the next day, do the interview, get packed, leave for Sacramento. We've texted back and forth a little bit in the interim. And then, as I'm going to Sacramento, right as I'm about to leave for Sacramento, I said, hey, so you're going to LA for business. I'm going to Sacramento for business. When you get back, maybe we can meet up at a regular time on Thursday and, like, have coffee or something. Uh-huh. So, I don't know what the fuck happened, but all of a sudden he started, like, it felt like I was being prosecuted. Well, you said you didn't, like, you couldn't make it to Burlingame before. I was like, well, I actually said I couldn't make it to Burlingame at 1 o'clock in the morning, or did not want to make it to Burlingame
right.
at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then, anyway, but it just continued, and it escalated and escalated and escalated. Finally, I said, look, like, I'm not interested in arguing this. Like, I don't understand the point in this. Like, I asked if you want to meet on Thursday.
You could have just said no.
You could have said no, or you could have said yes. And so, yes or no, it's not a,
right.
like, it's not a, you're crazy for whatever. Right. Anyway, so, at this point, I'm like, bitch, I don't want to meet you. Because there's right. something going on here that's point, like, you're right. an unstable Mabel. So, I just stopped responding, which clearly...
Drove him insane?
Insane. He started sending me, like, I'm talking, like... On my text, I would have to, like, scroll 2 times to get from the top of the message to the bottom.
Oh, shit.
And then it just kept getting worse and worse. I stopped responding. So I think that he has moved on. Hours later, I'm now in Sacramento, and I get a message that's like, you're just a fucking slut. Why don't you admit it? You're acting like your mother, Teresa. And yet I was like, and then it got even nastier and nastier, and I didn't respond to any of those. So I don't.
Oh my goodness! See, this is why you don't give your number off on the first message, girl.
So I blocked him on the app, and then I deleted all the messages and whatever. And 24 hours go by. So like, I come home, everything. By the way, while we were in Sacramento, my friend Zachary Dyer, you met Zachary, right? Remember? Uh-huh. Zachary almost got hit by a car, and he was, like, running to get out. Some car came speeding by right in front of the club, and he, like, tried to get out of the way and tripped and fell and hit his knee, and he broke a bone in his knee and ripped 3 ligaments in his knee.
Holy shit.
And yet the bitch still stayed for the whole drag show and was, like, whooping it up. So, Zachary, thank you for being such, like...
Oh, my God.
Like, so supportive. I don't even know what to say, except get well soon, boo. Okay, so, come home and... go about my life. Yesterday, I interviewed the Ross Matthews, which will be later in this episode, too. And then last night, I'm laying down to go to bed at midnight, and I get a text message. Oh, and you're a fucking drag queen, too? Like, you're... So, the person who I stopped thinking about straight up completely cyber-stalked me. Knew my address. Mm-hmm. Knew, like... And then went through all this stuff, and he started threatening, what are you going to do if I show up at your door? Nothing. You're not going to do nothing. Like, and he's like, I'm so glad we didn't meet. And I, like, could not manage to not say, I was like, me too. Now that we agree on something, can you please stop contacting me?
Right.
Then he proceeded to make threats against my mother's employment. Like, I'll call and get your mother fired. And like, what? All this stuff. I was like, my favorite thing that he said to me, though, was, wait until this gets all over social media. Wait until what gets all over social media? That you are fucking crazy?
Right.
Like, first of all, if you are out there listening and you are psychotic also, I would like you to know. I would like you to know something. You cannot threaten to expose somebody.
When you're the one who was a mess,
but even more than that, like, you can't expose anything about me. You can't, what are you going to do, reveal that I'm a drag queen?
Right.
Hello? Everybody knows it. But even more than that, like, we didn't really even say, like, I didn't really say anything nasty to him. Like, you know, right. It wasn't, like, a sexting type of thing. He did see some nasty pictures. like, because they were on the app or whatever, and I unlocked them for him, but I locked those and I blocked them. But the thing is, like, even if that leaked or whatever, I don't put anything anywhere in the world that I'm not comfortable with knowing could get out to the world. And that's the thing. If you think you're going to shame me, motherfucker, for something that happened in this text message, you bumped your head, bitch. I live my life open and in the public and authentically. I don't lie about shit. I don't, like, this crazy bitch, like, sounds like a self-loathing individual who's got, like, all kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I'm assuming that if I revealed something about you, you might feel shame because you seem to be trying to, like, hide some of this. I don't have any shame for this. Like, I talked with somebody who seemed attractive, turned out to be fucking psychotic, crazy individual. Like, what are you going to do? Like he was like, right. I don't talk to faggots like you. And I said, oh my God, thank you. Because faggots like me don't talk to crazy people.
Right.
So can we please leave me alone?
Right.
So he kept sending threats and I kept saying, thank you. Can you please leave me alone now? Thank you. Have a good night now. Thank you. I copied it. Thank you. Have a good night. And every time you'd message, I would just say that. And finally, he left me alone. I'm assuming that this is the type of person, this will probably be ongoing for a little while. But girl, I talked to him for literally 12 hours before he went off the deep end. And after that, I didn't even respond. And he's still, like, doing all this stalking. I said, he goes, you're a fucking drag queen. I was like, and you're a fucking stalker, which is worse in society.
Right.
Like, he's like, I'm not stalking you. My phone just updated and gave me all this information. Bitch, I don't
get... My phone updated and gave me all this information
about you. No,
you was a fucking lie.
Even if my phone did update and, like, send me, like...
It's not going to tell me somebody's address, girl, based off the phone number.
Right, or if it gave me somebody's social media links or whatever, bitch, the stalker part is that you actually fished through this and went to information. Mm-hmm. If my phone updated and gave me his information, I'd have deleted that shit just like I deleted his phone number and all his hateful messages. Whoa. And my other one is like, I'm going to call into that radio show you do and give you grief without you even knowing it's me.
Oh, my God. Girl, get the number.
Bitch, please try calling in. I would clown your ass for the world to listen to. You are psycho.
I would live, girl. What's his name?
I'm not going to say his name. That's the thing. Like, I'm not cuckoo like that. Like,
girl, I am.
He did give me what he contends is, like, his business card. You know, he showed me his business card or whatever. And he contends that he's, like, some kind of a high-powered attorney or something like that who's worked at this really nice job for a long time. And I'm thinking to myself, if you can be this unstable emotionally and mentally and hold a job down for a long time, you're a better person than most people are. Like, I find it very difficult to believe that somebody who flips out and is so crazy like this could possibly... I'm not saying a crazy person can't be well-educated or all this stuff, because that's totally possible.
Right.
But... to hold a long-term corporate job, you can't be, like, some unstable Mabel.
Never.
Like, they'd be like, okay, well, you're really valuable, but you're also insane and terrifying and probably...
a harm to our company. You got to go.
Yeah, I mean, girl, I mean, it's obvious to me that if you can talk to somebody, like, if you can text message without ever meeting for, like, a few hours and then go off the deep end and start stalking people, that means I'm not the first bitch this has happened to.
Right.
I'm not the second one. I'm not even the 10th one. This person is 55 years old. I bet you there are people for years who've been fucking finding him hiding in their shrubbery.
Right.
Okay. No, ma'am, Pam.
And you are 55 years old.
55.
You need to act like it.
Girl, that's a mess. It's terrifying. It is really terrifying that, I mean, I don't know. The craziest part is I started telling this story to my BFF, Shigella. And she goes, oh my God, I know exactly who this person is. Apparently, he messaged her before, and, like, she didn't, like, message him right away, but apparently they had nice conversation, because this is what I would like to say about this person. The first, like, few hours of our conversation, like, the night before, the night of that we started talking, was really pleasant. And even some of the conversation in the morning time was really pleasant, but something happened. I don't even know specifically what it was. But it was like flipping a switch, and it was like literally felt like talking to a completely different person. So my best friend had an interaction with this person too, and the person also made all these crazy threatening things and, like, found all this information about him, and it freaked Shigella out. I mean, obviously, like, it's a little unnerving
girl,
for me.
I'm like, shell at. Girl, shell at.
It's a little unnerving for me too, but And he goes, go ahead, call the police. I'll call them. I'll report you too. I'm sure you have warrants outstanding. I was like,
what
please.
What are you talking about?
That's what the person said. Like, I was like, by all means, please, you call the police. That way they're involved in this from go. And like, hold on. I'm going to see if I have this, where it is. I'm going to show you some of this shit that he said. Look. But no worries, call the police. I don't care, but I do know one thing about you. You just cost your mom a job, idiot. What? Like, I cost my mom a job by not responding to your text messages, okay? Right. Fuck you, I hate drag queens with a passion. Thank you, have a good night. Dumb, stupid stunt queen, thank you, have a good night. That's all you drag queens do is stunt and steal.
What?
I just may call the police myself because I'm sure you have warrants on you. Thank you, have a good night. Like,
girl,
it's like, yeah. And then here, this is where he like, while I'm at it, your mom down in Florida, I don't want people like your kind working with us. Cause allegedly they might work for the same company. Hello. It's like a Fortune 500 company. There's like a bazillion people. Well, since you wanted to lie and act stupid, I didn't lie. He says I was lying by suggesting that he wanted to meet up at 1 o'clock. Anyway. How fucking gross, misrepresenting yourself, and you're a fucking drag queen. Bitch, I didn't misrepresent myself.
Right.
It's not like I sent him a literal photo of myself, like, in the moment. I was like, this is what I look like right now in bed, like, you know, like a selfie, like, next to the window, like I always post on Facebook. Bitch, there was no lying. I didn't misrepresent myself. I'd known you for, like, 5 minutes. I'm not gonna fucking tell, like, what am I supposed to, like, it's not... He wouldn't have known anything about me except my name and phone number if the bitch hadn't stalked me.
Well, let this be a lesson to everybody, though. And I, you know, I've learned this. Do not give your number out to just anybody, girl, because they will... It's one thing to send you a message in an app, but you could block them really easy on an app. Your phone, girl, your phone has access to all kinds of information about you.
Right, and that is something that this was a lesson for me. What I think I'm going to do now is I think I'm going to set up like a Google phone number and go into all my social media and change that phone number to a Google phone number that is sort of untraceable. Not because I'm trying to hide anything.
Or give the Google number to these people.
Right. Like I am not trying to, certainly not trying to hide anything. I wasn't trying to hide anything from this fucking moron. But the fact of the matter is his stalkery has shown me that everything is available to like if you want it. Right there, based on a phone number. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, this is fucking whack. And the fact that some random-ass bitch can do this...
Oh, yeah, like, girl. There's plenty I found out just through someone's phone number.
I mean, I guess that never occurred to me because I'm not an unstable Mabel. So, like, this dude clearly off the deep end. And, of course, as you know, like, Shigella... is always diagnosing somebody or whatever. Girl, I was sending her like up, I was telling her about this incident, but I was getting ready for a show. So I'm like, instead of typing it out, cause it's a hell of a long story. I just was sending her like voice memos, like 45 seconds at a time. And there's like five of them. And she responds back, girl, I'm not even through the second memo, but I know exactly who this is. And like, here's all his diagnoses.
Oh my God.
And she's like, and she was like, I beg you, do not engage with him because he seems like the type of person who could potentially be physically violent. Terrifying. But girl, that's okay. It's not like I'm some small person.
Right. You guys remember the time Pollo was knocking hoes out in the middle of the street saving kids.
I mean, meanwhile, I'm like, that's fine. Go ahead and show up at my house. I'll start sleeping with a... I don't believe in firearms, but I'll sleep with a frying pan next to the bed, bitch. There's one right there hanging. I bet you I can get a good grip and fucking show a bitch the door with one. I was like, listen, do you value your nose, bitch? Because it's about to be 4 inches wide and flat as a fucking pancake.
Girl.
And don't worry, it'll clean off this Teflon skillet, motherfucker. You better... Bitch, keep it rolling.
But
keep it stepping, hoes. Keep it stepping. But now we're fully aware why I'm like really not diving up in that dating pool.
Girl, that is the one crazy person out of how many you've talked to.
Right. Well, how come it is that the only person who like returns my messages is the crazy one?
Well,
and they're
all
threatening.
Well,
bitch, please. So, you know. All right. Oh, I got a cute text message from our sponsors, Jesse Van Seal and Arlen Lassiter at Daddy's Barbershop, congratulating us on Party Foul Radio breaking into Podomatic's top 10.
Talk. You know.
We are top 10 in talk radio in the entire Podomatic world, you guys.
So again, we have to thank all of you hoes out there.
Oh, that sounds so loving. All you hoes.
You know, for pimping out our podcast to all your friends, because we know you do.
Thank you for listening in. But Jesse, and I want to give, a few weeks ago, I told you guys that Jesse Van Seal, who is one of the co-owners of Daddy's Barbershop and who's such a strong supporter of our podcast, both as a fiscal sponsor and just as a friend of the podcast, was in the hospital for 2 weeks. Wow. And they finally were able to diagnose what was wrong with him. They've got him on medication. He's back on his feet, out of the hospital, getting back to usual. So glad to hear that, Jesse. So glad that you're doing, like, got your health back in order.
Right.
And, girl, they've got the Daddy's Barbershop leather competition coming up.
With Folsom, I'm sure they're
super with Folsom, they're, like, going to be very busy. And they're working towards opening the new Daddy's Barbershop down in Palm Springs. So, you know, Jesse, Arlen Lassiter is the other co-owner. And he's in the shop because he's actually a barber and he's there all the time. Jesse is the person who's, like, behind the scenes running the business and helping with, like, expansion and all this stuff. So the two of them together are a great team, but with Jesse being sick, like, you know, they got a lot of shit on their plate.
I'm sure.
So luckily, Jeff Millard, who we know is Mr. San Francisco Leather 2017, who has been on the podcast, did so amazingly well at IML this year, and who we just love to pieces. He will probably be helping Jesse, like, really stepping in to help plan their barbershop leather competition to find out who will be the new Daddy's Barbershop, Mr. Daddy's Barbershop. But I'm just really glad for Jesse that he's back on his feet, because it's very scary. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I know, for sure.
It's really scary that somebody's in there and, you know, it was his lungs, you guys. He was having real issues with his lungs. So, bitch, ain't nothing like when you can't breathe, girl.
Right, exactly.
Nothing like that.
Speaking of which, are you going to Folsom?
I don't know if I'm going to go to Folsom or not. I am working a private gig this weekend. A gal pal of mine from San Diego is going to be coming up to the city, and we're doing a special private birthday party.
Uh-huh.
And that's on Saturday night, so I won't even get to go to Ducal Coronation. I thought I was going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I will maybe go to Folsom. I just generally don't go to Folsom. I don't like deep, like, huge crowds like that. I don't like feeling trapped. Folsom, like, Dory Alley is bad enough, and then you quadruple the size of it for Folsom.
Yeah.
And bitch, it is wall to wall. The one thing I will say I did a few years ago, we have this group within our fraternity, which we call bromos, like the homos the brothers who are homos, the bromos. And we're alumni from all over the country, Sigma Phi Epsilon alumni. Shout out to the bromos. And we met up at the Eagle on Sunday of Folsom a few years ago. And that was a fucking blast. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll see if the bromos are going to do that again this year, because if I'm not working on Sunday, which to my knowledge I'm not, that means I could actually go out and enjoy, like, the whole day. And, you know, it's a little different when you know that you have to go do this shit in the morning and early afternoon and then go home and get ready and go to work that night.
Right.
You know? So are you planning on going? Are you going to put electrical tape over your nips and just be out there topless, you slut?
I am a lady, so no, I will not be doing that.
Oh, bitch, please. She's like, I'm a lady?
But
unless I'm an Asia SF, and then my breasticles are just hanging. Right. Oh, and she had a fucking straight-up nip slip at the Design Meets Divas of Drag.
Oh, whatever,
she did a perla wheel, and her titty just fell straight out of the get-up, bitch.
No, but it looked wonderful, girl. It matched my little nipple coverage. It matched my outfit.
Whatever. Lovely. Slut. I told you guys, slut.
No, girl. It just happened on accident. That wasn't planned.
So did Janet Jackson.
And they loved it, girl. They lived.
Anyway, go on.
But I'm hoping that I do work at AJSF to get, like, the
fun. She puts the hoe in hoping, bitch.
I will be that night, girl. But I don't know. I kind of want to go, but I kind of just hope I work at Asia just so I can deal with it in a concealed environment.
Right. I will say that one of the things that I always do love, I love the energy to some degree that comes along with these big event weekends in the city, but actually being down in that environment and, like, sort of just feeling...
It's a lot.
It is. It's, like, a lot of stimulation. You feel a little bit claustrophobic and trapped.
And it's always hot.
And hot AF. And, like, I mean, the thing about Folsom, too, is not only is it crowded, but people are in various states of dress or undress. And mm-hmm. sometimes I'm just like, ooh, I don't want your taint pressing against me, bitch. Right. Ooh, I don't want your taint pressing against me.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know.
But you do get to see some really neat exhibits and shows.
Yeah,
and...
I mean, there's some fun stuff down there. So maybe I will, if I can...
I kind of just want to go out and buy some toys.
If I can put together a posse to go with, I probably will consider it. You know, I actually had never thought about it because for 7 years, I've always been working that night. And it's not really been much of an option for me because for me to go down to do something like this, I feel worn out. And then to know that I have to, like, somehow get it together and go on stage that night is just not so fucking cute for me.
I usually go at least just for the food.
It's hungry, hungry hippos.
Y'all remember last year Pearl was talking about the food at Folsom too, bitch?
Yeah, I usually go and that's the first thing. I go straight for the food and I'm happy. So... That's probably what's going to happen again this year. I don't know.
And I wonder, you know what? I almost wish that we had a little booth set up there. We could be giving out all this fucking Swiss Navy premium personal lubricant down at Folsom.
We could have had our lube wrestling thing then.
We could,
That would have been perfect.
God.
Should have been on it, Poyo.
See, look, you guys, she fucking pushes everything. You should have been on it, Poyo.
She's a producer, girl.
I know I'm the producer, but this bitch barely... Her only responsibility for the show, you guys, is to show up and talk for 2 hours. Meanwhile, as the show has gone
on... That's my job, girl.
Meanwhile, as the show has progressed, she shows up and I'll be like, okay, you guys, I'm like, okay, Pearl, I got almost an hour of pre-recorded stuff for this. Fierce, bitch, fierce.
Yeah,
she's here and gone in 30 minutes and then that's it. And then she's like, you should have been on it, Poyo. You should have been on it. Fucking this lazy bitch.
No, not at all, girl. I'm down to do the work, but I just do what I'm hired to do.
Bitch, I need to rehire. I need a new hire to do this. Considering Ross Matthews is going to be on later this episode, and he got his big break as Ross the intern on The Tonight Show, we need a fucking intern.
we do.
If you're out there and
now,
you live,
girl,
in the Bay Area...
You don't
and you,
want it. And trust you, me, you'll end up just cleaning up the so-called studio, which is Poyo's house. That's going to be your main responsibility,
No,
girl.
If you want to be an intern on Party Foul Radio with Poyo and Pearl, you need to hit us up. Follow us on Twitter or Facebook.
Both. Not Twitter or Twitter and.
Well, yes. Twitter and Facebook at Party Foul Radio. And let us know that you want to be our intern, girl. We need an intern. So, we need an intern for the show.
What would you have this intern do besides clean up?
I would have the intern. There's all kinds of things an intern could help us do. Help us do marketing promotions. Help us do plan like fun events, like going to Folsom and stuff like that. Like, I mean, there's a lot that could be done. You will not get paid.
You will not get paid
at all.
But
at all.
But there's fun fucking shit you could do, and you could, you know.
Get some free Swiss Navy premium lube.
Bitch, you could get all kinds of things. We can get you on board for some fun shit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let us know. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we will be back with more Party Foul Radio and our interview with Ross Matthews right after this.
Hi, it's Ross Matthews, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio.
Each and every episode of Party Foul Radio is brought to you by our sponsors, Daddy's Barbershop. Located at 4102 19th Street in the Castro, Daddy's Barbershop was voted San Francisco's favorite barbershop in the 2017 Bestie Awards. Go visit Arlen, Jesse, and all the men and women of Daddy's Barbershop to get your hair done for the summer. Daddy's Barbershop is a proud sponsor of Party Foul Radio. And we're back with more Party Foul Radio. I am your co-host, Ms. Poyo Del Mar, and we are excited to have with us at this time, he is our first guest this episode. You can see him on each and every episode of RuPaul's Drag Race, where he is one of the judges, but we got to know him over a decade ago as Ross, the gay intern on Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and we've seen his career develop onward and upward since then. Please welcome to Party Foul Radio the adorable and hilarious Ross Matthews, everyone. Hi, Ross.
How are you?
I am great. How are you?
Good.
I'm super excited that you decided to talk with us today. I don't know if you remember, but you and I worked together at Gay Day at Great America a few years ago. And
That was so fun.
You know, I will tell you, I always talk about you in such a glowing way because one of the things that stood out to me was all, you know, there's a lot of contracts for all of us who do those kind of things, but you were so willing to interact with the fans afterwards and take photos, and so many people were not willing to do that, and I just thought that that has always stayed with me.
Well, that's the whole point, right? I mean, I always say that they're the boss. You know, the audience, really, at the end of the day, is the boss. So if they know who you are, I mean, you have a job, you know? And plus, I just like meeting people. I'm always sticking around.
So much has happened for you since then. I mean, what was it like when you got the call to start being, like, a regular judge on Drag Race?
Oh, my gosh. So, okay. I, like everybody who's staying in the world, was a huge fan of the show, right? And I would watch during the episodes at home, and I would, like, talk at the TV. And then they asked me to be a guest judge once, and I was like, yes, because I have something to say. And so I just was intimidated, you know? And then I couldn't believe it when they said, do you want to join full time? It was one of those words where you, like, look behind you. Like, you talking to me? And I don't know why they asked me. I don't know why they chose me. But asked us yes before he finished the sentence. And it is a dream gig. It is so much fun because I really, truly am the fan that won the golden ticket, you know?
Right. I totally could believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know that you're not allowed to tell any details, but you guys are filming right now, right? So you're, like, slipped away to chat with us, which is incredible.
I will not confirm nor deny. Uh-huh.
Right, exactly. So last season, I have to ask you, because last season we always seem to see so many people from New York. Other places don't seem to be as well represented, and without, like, saying what we have this coming year, but as a fan of the show and as a person who's traveled so extensively and met performers from all over the world, presumably, would you like to see us have representation from a wider spectrum of cities?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I travel all over, and I always go to a gay bar and every city I go to, I always see drag shows, and I'm blown away by the talent that I see every time in the audience, whether, you know, Palm Springs or Key West, I see a queen and go, oh my gosh, why is she not on the show? And I understand, though, why there's so many from New York. I mean, there are just more drag queens in New York. And that scene is really envelope pushing, you know what I mean?
Right.
And edgy. I mean, we're always looking for the best of drag and what's new in drag. So it makes sense that a lot of that comes from New York. But they've also done, the producers have done a really good job showing queens from the south, queens from the north, queens from, we've had Charlie Hyde, who lives in London. You know, we've had Latina queens, we've had plus size queens, we've had queens of color. I think they've actually done a really good job. And it's tough, there's only 13 girls per season, and there are so many more talented queens now than any time in history.
Yeah, I definitely think that. Because, well, I mean, the one thing as a drag performer that I've always appreciated about the show is that it has returned drag queens to a position of celebrity within the community, whether you've been on the show or not, that we enjoyed for many years, because drag queens are envelope pushing and they are the most outspoken, because generally speaking, we are the most marginalized in many capacities next to transgender women, because, like, we're the most obvious, you know. Like, we can't really fly under the radar, most of us.
As somebody who can totally pass for straight, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, listen, it's true. Drag queens have always been on the front lines in our community. I mean, going back to Stonewall and before. And now I feel like we've always respected them within our community, but I think people outside of the LGBTs, the Qs, the IVAs, they're kind of getting it now because of the show.
Well, I would even say that, Ross, I would challenge you on that, because I think there was a time when what the gay community wanted was to be considered the same as straight people. And, like, straight acting is still such, and that's in quotes, you guys, like, straight acting is like yeah. still
I
like
get what you're saying.
So preferred and like
I never felt that way. Okay. And my friends never felt that way. But I know about that in within our community.
It was so frustrating, and I'm really glad that once again drag is at the forefront of what our community is because it's such uh-huh. an integral part. Now, I wanted to ask you your thoughts because I was recently talking to a friend, and I feel that one of the possible downsides that has come with Drag Race is that because it's such a cultural phenomenon beyond even the gay community, that I feel like there's a responsibility for the show to really educate viewers and the contestants as to what our history is. And there, early on in the show series, there was a lot of more educational stuff kind of to expose people to what our gay history or herstory was. And, you know, are there going to be efforts going forward, do you think, for the show to be a little more educational in its purpose in that way?
I honestly think that's a question for the producers, but I'll tell you this. I think the show absolutely has done that and will always continue to do that just by existing. I don't know that there is necessarily a pressure felt to educate. I know there's certainly a pressure felt to entertain. But just because we are sort of something that was niche at one time within a community that is now becoming mainstream, I just think by nature it's going to educate people. I think by telling gay stories, meeting gay people, and really having them expose themselves in a beautiful way. I mean, there's some people, they're most vulnerable, trying their best to the best at what they do. And so it becomes very human. And I think that is what's educating people. Of course, their culture, they get to the culture, what it's like to be a member of a culture. But really just showing humanity is like the common core that everyone can relate to. I think that's educating people. I don't think you're ever going to see like a history lesson of gay or drag culture 101 on the show. I think that just comes from the vernacular we use, the challenges in it. I think that's what's educating people. I don't know if they feel that pressure. I know they feel the pressure to entertain and make a colorful, good show, but I don't know. That's an interesting question for them.
Well, and the reason I ask, for example, is because certainly you, as a show, give exposure to our cultural icons that are very mainstream, Madonna or maybe a Kylie Minogue or something like that. But, you know, there's so much of our culture. I remember what I'm specifically thinking of in many ways is I was flashing back to when Lee Bowery was an inspiration for a Mimi I'm First Look. And many people on the show, even yeah. other contestants, had no idea that reference. You know what I mean? And so.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm saying, is that the references, the people, it's people are Googling, like sometimes they, when they do snap scenes and they do, you know, when Alaska did come up and see me sometime, right? They left, I was like, oh my gosh, everyone's going to be Googling who is Mae West, you know?
Right, of course.
Just by its nature, our show with the people and the stories we tell are educating people.
Now, in relation to that, because of the fact that we talk about how the show does, in a beautiful way, expose gay stories that make us vulnerable and human to people who watch. We're not just gay people, we're people who have parental problems or we're people who have, you know, economic, you know, disadvantages, whatever the case may be, allowing people to relate to us. As a person who is obviously very out there in the community and very much a member of it, do you feel some kind of a personal responsibility to represent in a certain way to kind of, I mean, I'm just curious if there's the concept behind any element of what you do that you have become
yes.
an unofficial
yes.
spokesperson. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I feel this pressure only within myself, and it's only to fulfill something that wasn't there when I was a kid. I grew up in a farm town, and I knew I was gay, and I didn't know what a grown-up gay person looked like.
Right.
There was nobody on TV. There was nobody in movies that I could point to and say, oh, okay, my life could be like that. I could be open and happy and successful and have a partner. I mean, think about that. I really thought to myself, what is the future for me? You know, well, what does it even look like? I couldn't picture it. And so when I got on television, even, you know, when I started in 2001 in the early Tonight Show days, I said to myself, like,
I love how you sort of swallowed that year, by the way. You're like,
Say what?
I loved how you sort of like swallowed the year because you were like in 2001.
Well, 2001. 2000, I've been on TV. 16 years I've been going on TV. And but I remember thinking then like, okay, be that example you've never had. Be that example. And so that's always driven me. And I, you know, people tell me now. That's why I didn't mean to follow your stuff. Because people come up to me now and say, I've been watching you since I used to like stay awake when I was in, you know, sixth grade and watch you on Leno. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how great for them. This little gay kid could point the TV and see this big gay clown named Ross Matthews and think, wow, you know, look, my parents are smiling when he's on TV. They must like gay people. Or, oh, look, he's grown up and not afraid or embarrassed about who he is. Maybe I shouldn't be, you know? And there's a lot of us now, but that's always driven me.
I really think that that's super important, and I think the idea of being the example or being the person that you did not have is something that any of us who are socially conscious kind of think. I mean, I on a very localized level, I feel that same way because there are people who have, like, I was the first drag queen they ever saw at an 18 and over club or something. You know what I mean? And I'm like, if I'm a horrible person, they're going to think that that's what this is about. Or, you know, I tried to let that motivate me as a little bit as a human.
Yeah, I love that.
So you've had so many opportunities and you've worked with incredible people. I mean, you're on RuPaul and you spent a great deal of time with Chelsea Handler. I remember you called her and you left a voicemail from the stage at Gay Day at Great America. But I mean, has there been a moment or a celebrity or an individual that you worked with and you were like, oh my gay gods, this is actually happening?
Oh, all the time. I mean, RuPaul, of course, is one. I remember interviewing Dolly Parton, interviewing Liza Minnelli, interviewing Jane Fonda, meeting Rosie O'Donnell, you know, Anderson Cooper. I am a fan at the end of the day, but that happens more often than not. There's some people who I've met in interview that I can give a crap about. You know, like, I don't want to show. I don't know. You know, but then there are people who you just blows your mind. I mean, on my list is I want to meet the Benefit Contessa.
Oh my God.
I just love her. I watch her every day, at least one episode. And Adele. I'd love to meet Adele.
Yeah, I think one of the things, you know, as a viewer or as an audience member who has watched your evolution, I will say that I think one of the most charming things about you to this day is that you have that, you've not crossed that line from very well-known and established entertainer who is a huge fan of people into that realm of celebrity where you're like, this is my world and of course I hang out with this person.
Let me say, I've seen people, I've seen friends of mine who have crossed over into that line, and I know exactly what you're talking about, where it's like, oh my God, you're no longer one of us, an observer, you now become one of them, the famous people, you know, and I totally get what you mean, and no matter what success I achieve in my life, and nothing more that I do, I will never cross that line, because I love pop culture. You know, I love being a fan. I am perfectly happy in this position. I love it.
Right. It's like you get the sense of like being the unpopular kid in school whose best friend suddenly becomes popular and you're excluded suddenly.
Well, you know, and it was funny that you even say that because we just did the Emmys, right? And like I have been covering them for like 15 years. And for the first time, I got to walk the carpet as part of the eight-time nominated and winning RuPaul's Drag Race. And we walked together, and I turned to Ru at one point, and I was like, I feel like we're the misfits who get to sit at the popular kids' table for a day. And he was like, exactly, that's exactly it. Because we really are, and I think that's why our show resonates with people, because we are like the misfits who are pulling this off, you know, the little show that could. And like I told you at the very beginning of the interview, I'm the fan that won the golden ticket. I am just so happy. I'm happy that you know who I am and you want to talk to me and you watch this show. I'm so happy. So thank you
Thanks, Ross. You are such a gem. I am so happy for your success, and thank you for sharing your time with us.
Of course, baby. And I hope to see you again, and you keep it up, okay?
Thanks so much, sweetheart. Bye.
Bye, honey. Bye. Hi, it's Ross Matthews, and you're listening to Party Foul Radio.
Each episode of Party Foul Radio is brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine. Pick up your copy of Left Magazine today in the Castro for all of the celebrity interviews, beautiful photo pictorials, and updates on everything new, hot, and happening in Northern California's LGBTQ nightlife and entertainment scene. That's San Francisco's Left Magazine on newsstands throughout the Castro, or visit them online at liveleft.com. That's liveleft.com. And we're back with more Party Foul Radio. I'm your co-host, Ms. Poya Del Mar, and I am excited to have with us at this time our second of three huge celebrity interviews this episode. Our next guest is an Oscar-nominated actress who got her career beginnings in the 80s, where she starred in such iconic films as Adventures in Babysitting, before being reborn as a dramatic actress for her Oscar-nominated turn in the film Leaving Las Vegas, for which Nicolas Cage did win Best Lead Actor. She lost out to Susan Sarandon's performance in Dead Man Walking that year. But she has continued to work, including a 3.5-year stint on CSI on television, as well as a return to the big screen in this week's opening of Battle of the Sexes. Emma Stone, Steve Carell, and Elizabeth Shue, as well as Bill Pullman, star in a big screen adaptation of the story of Billie Jean King, the tennis great who, at the height of her career in the early 70s, was not only battling to hide her sexuality as a lesbian, but also found herself in the middle of a war of the sexes in which she faced former tennis great Bobby Riggs in what was called the Battle of the Sexes to prove that men and women are equal both on and off the court. Please welcome at this time to Party Foul Radio, star of Battle of the Sexes, which opens in select theaters on September 22nd and nationwide September 29th. Put your hands together for Miss Elizabeth Shue, everybody.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Can you hear me?
I can. You're actually, the clarity is perfect. So, first of all, I am very excited to speak today because the year that Leaving Las Vegas was nominated for an Oscar was the first year I'd ever seen all of the Oscar nominees. And so, this is exciting and monumental for me in a way. So, thank you for speaking today. I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad. Yeah, that's one of my favorite films, obviously. But it's funny, I was saying to somebody that, you know, people don't realize how rare it is to be in movies that you really care about and you feel proud to be in. And obviously Leaving Las Vegas is one of those for me. And this is another one. So I feel grateful that I got to be in another film that means as much to me.
Yeah, this film is important, I think, in many ways because, obviously, as a gay man, I think that it's important that stories of that represent the history of the LGBTQ community being told is very important. But I also think that this is a story that is significant to women because it's about women's rights as much as the struggle that she was going through as a lesbian woman in that time and era.
Yeah. Yeah, it works on both levels, which is so great. Because, yeah, and also it doesn't sort of pigeonhole it and make it, oh, it's a movie about, you know, gay people, and then everyone who's straight is like, oh, it's a movie about gay people. It's like, no, it's a movie about women. It's about sexuality, but it's also about power, and it's about taking back your power and accepting yourself for who you are and being brave. Like, all these qualities that women really struggle to have in our society.
Yeah, and it seems as important now, actually, this struggle that the film portrays seems as important now in society as it ever has been. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's crazy in a way that when you watch it, I mean, I took from it some thoughts like women like Venus and Serena Williams and all of these tennis greats of today should be very grateful to Billie Jean King because she positioned them in a way that women in that industry, at least, would be paid equally, but we hear all the time that women in films don't make the same as men, and women in the workplace in general don't make as much as men. So it's still a battle that we're struggling with 40 years later.
Yep. Yeah, it's ongoing. Yeah, I was just reading the New York Times, like almost every morning I wake up and hear something about women struggling against either it's sexual harassment or it's equal pay or it's just self-respect or it's an ongoing issue. It really is. And hopefully, I feel like Wonder Woman was one movie, and I think this could be another one where women say, I'm going to see that to take a stand, to say that women deserve respect. I'm going to see that movie. And there's a power in films that are good films that show women who are brave and give young women an example of somebody who is willing to put their life on the line for something larger than themselves. That's really important, I think, in our culture. That sends huge signals to the rest of society that women are just as strong as ever.
You know, I was watching Battle of the Sexes, and one of the things that was so resonant for me is that here is this woman who, I remember, you know, the one scene where her opponent in the division says that she's going to take advantage of the fact that she's guilty and feels shame for who she is because she's aware of what's going on. And I thought that was so powerful because I really believe it speaks to the fact that when you're not living your truth, whatever that might be, and in this case, Billie Jean it was about her sexual identity, but when you're not living who you really are, your authentic self, you can't be your best in life. And it really does affect the way you live and, you know, how much potential you have.
Yeah.
I just thought that was so powerful.
It's true. And it was so exciting I was in the theater last night at the premiere with my two daughters on either side of me. And so proud to be in the film, to be in a film that speaks to them. And my 16-year-old got extremely emotional after it was over. I was so surprised by that because, you know, she had no connection to the Battle of the Sexes. And I don't think Billie Jean King, I'm a tennis fanatic, so I know who Billie Jean King is. And I also was actually alive during the Battle of the Sexes. I remember it. But she didn't have any connection. And she the scene that meant the most to her was when Emma cries at the end.
Yes.
And she said, I feel like she's crying for all of us. Whenever we feel less than.
Mm.
And oh my God. Here I'm a woman who is pretty evolved and relatively brave, could be more brave when it comes to speaking out, and here my daughter, who I hopefully have raised as a powerful woman as well, knows inside that there might be something less than in her just because she's a girl.
Ugh. Wow, that's really powerful. Like, I actually got I got tears like sprung to my eyes because I think that is something that so many people struggle with, that idea that something about us is less than. And it, you know, I think that for some of us, it's more pronounced. We're gay or we're a female or we are transgender or whatever the case might be. But
we think we're stupid or we have, you know, we're overweight or there's like a million ways that people feel less than.
Exactly. And I think that some of them are so much more obvious, you know, to other people see it. But the struggle really with Billie Jean in this story was that her struggle was within. People weren't even aware of what she was dealing with at the time, except herself, you know, and a few people close to her. But outwardly, she looked like she had everything going for her. And then inwardly, it was this tremendous battle that was as significant for her, obviously, as what was happening on that tennis court that day.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful statement. I think it's...
Yeah, I really really hope it does well, because unfortunately, too, the problem with these films is if they don't do well, that also sends a message. That,
absolutely.
Oh, society doesn't want to go see a movie about women, and, oh, that was, you know, they don't want to see anything historic, they don't want to see anything dramatic. So let's pray. I'm crossing my fingers that it does well enough that it does not become something negative for women.
Right, or the LGBT community, for that matter, because...
that's true. I didn't really think about that. I hope, although I do think I feel like the film has evolved past that pigeonhole. I really do. Like, that our society is not going to place that kind of label on it, and therefore not go. I feel like it's pretty strong that the message there is larger and more universal, and I'm praying for that.
Well, I pray for that too, but what I can tell you is that society as a whole, no matter how successful an individual is or how iconic a moment is like this one for Billie Jean King, ultimately, the world exists on labels, you know, because I think that now in society, Billie Jean King is remembered probably less as a tennis great and more as a lesbian icon or symbol of LGBT empowerment. I really think that no matter how incredible somebody is, if they are gay, they are a gay comic, they are a gay actor, they are a gay musician. That label always... We haven't evolved past that, I don't think, Elizabeth.
Really? Well, I definitely have evolved past that, so I just assume that everyone else has. I can't imagine... I don't see her that way. That's so... not at all. Like, zero. Zero part of me sees her that way. And I know my daughters don't see her that way. I think our younger generation is incredibly more evolved than even my generation and then the generation before. So I know in my heart that things are changing for the better. It's just so slow and annoying that there still are people out there that are small-minded and fearful and take their own judgments out on other people because they really don't like themselves. I know that that's the reason. If you really feel whole and you accept yourself and love yourself, there's no reason to go out and judge anybody else. What would be the point?
Oh, absolutely. And especially when it comes to sexuality, there's no reason to be uncomfortable with somebody else's sexuality if you're comfortable in your own. It's like, well, okay, so it doesn't interest you. There's a lot of things that don't interest me, but I don't have to, like, tear it down. It just doesn't interest me.
Yeah. Well, that's because you feel you feel whole. You feel like you're okay the way you are.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's all fear. All judgment and prejudice comes from fear.
Now, I wanted to ask you, because in more recent years, we've known you for roles on television a little bit more. There was a time, certainly, when people who were movie stars did not do television. And I was curious, was your move towards television more recently based on a lack of film roles for actresses who are not 25?
Not really. I mean, I feel like... I've always had a up and down career. I don't think it's ever just been sailing smoothly right to the top. It's kind of been a bumpy road, and I think it's different. I think there was a good, 10-year period where, yes, there were not too many great opportunities in film, but I scrounged around and kind of kept working and kept having my family, and the balance was right because I actually have three children, and I really love being a mom, and I would have hated so much to have missed out on any of their moments. So I'm really grateful that I could just plug along and barely stay in it. But at some certain point, I did need to help out with the finances of the family, and I realized that I was putting that burden on my husband too much. He's a documentarian, and it was a little unfair for him to take that all on. So I tried to find something that I could both make a living at and also really respected the people involved. And so CSI actually worked for 3.5 years. I adore Ted Danson, and the cast members in that show are you know, just top-notch people, and the crew and the producers, all of them are just really, really hardworking, lovely, lovely people. So those 3.5 years were well spent with them. Now, I think if I would go do television, I would try to find something that's incredibly character-driven, something that would really inspire me as an actress fully. And so I'm always open to that and looking for that constantly and trying to develop something on my own.
You're a hustler.
Yeah, there are very few parts in movies, it's obvious.
Right.
For even for young people who are dramatic actresses, it's a tough time. And thank God that television is, I think most of the great writing and most of the great storytelling is now changed and gone to television, which is why everybody's there. You know, we were just saying tonight for the Best Actress category, every single person is like a movie star.
Wow, yeah.
So, yeah, Nicole Kidman, Reese, you know, Hulk, there's like five, oh yeah, Susan Sarandon, Jessica Lange, Felicity Huffman's the only, well, she's done film too, but, you know, she's the only one who's not the obvious movie star.
Right. I mean, it's very different time because I know you're aware of what I'm talking about. In the 80s, for example, there was a clearly defined difference between movie stars and TV stars. And both were wildly successful and, you know, household names, but there was this really clear division. And now they're everywhere. Like movie stars, bona fide Oscar winners everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a very cool time to be a viewer of television. Now, one of the things I definitely wanted to ask you about in this film is, like, one of the things that struck me so much when I was watching it is how, even amidst conflict, everybody in this film is such a, I had real compassion for everyone. I mean, Bobby Riggs obviously is the antagonist in some ways, but he's still so likable as a dad, and your character is in great conflict with him, but it's never mean-spirited. And I just took away from this, like, I don't know if they, I thought to myself, I don't know if they're cleaning this up for Hollywood and, you know, film, whatever, but for the love of God, her husband, Billie Jean's husband, should be sainted. I was like, this man is a beautiful spirit. He just loves her to the point where everything else is an aside, for the most part, it seemed like.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you know, Larry King was actually at the premiere last night. He was seeing it for the first time, and you could feel that he was that he had the essence of Austin's performance was right on. Just he was just so evolved and accepting, and could see the bigger picture. And I think love, when it is true acceptance, is so powerful. And I think both Priscilla and Larry both had to learn that level of acceptance ultimately. I mean, I actually threw him out and then took him back in. And look, Larry, I don't think ever threw her out. They stayed together. They were business partners. They're friends to this day.
I was shocked to read, you know, at the end of the film that he made her the godmother to his children. I was like, this is, it was that alone, like that little portion right there was like, wow, it was inspiring because we only, of course, get to see that climactic period of time leading up to the Battle of the Sexes playoff. But just to know that the story continued forward in such a positive way. And,
yeah.
You know, for both Bobby and Priscilla and Larry and Billie Jean, like it was a very inspiring watch for me. It got me quite emotional.
I'm so glad. Unfortunately, they're telling me now I have to get off because like we're like under the gun here. We have like 10 in a row kind of situation.
No, I'm grateful to hear that because that means that people want to talk about this film and that's important.
Yeah. So, well, I'm so glad that you're covering it. It's very, very important that I don't know, just that this movie is celebrated from everybody. So thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Have a wonderful day and best of luck. Let's keep our fingers crossed that this film is well received. I personally loved it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
All right. Bye.
Bye. That was Oscar nominee Elizabeth Shue. You can find her on the big screen now in the film Battle of the Sexes. It's the Billie Jean King story. It traces Billie Jean King's experience as the top female tennis player in the world in the early 70s. And while she is on a career trajectory that takes her to the top of that division, she's on a personal trajectory that finds her in direct conflict with her personal relationships, including a husband at the time, as she's exploring her sexuality as a lesbian woman. Battle of the Sexes stars Elizabeth Shue, Emma Stone as Billie Jean King, and many more of our television and film favorites. Go check it out at your local theaters. Battle of the Sexes is in theaters now. I'm Poya Delmar. You're listening to Party Foul Radio, and we'll be back with more right after this. This and every episode of Party Foul Radio is brought to you in conjunction with our media sponsor, GuideToGay.com. GuideToGay.com is Australia's favorite destination online for information relating to news, travel, entertainment, celebrity interviews, and much more of interest to the LGBTQ community. Please visit our media sponsors, GuideToGay.com. That's GuideToGay.com. All right, we are back with more Party Foul Radio. We have heard so many incredible interviews this episode. Ross Matthews and Oscar nominee Elizabeth Shue. You guys, once again, I gave a major thumbs up to Battle of the Sexes last week. Battle of the Sexes opens this Friday, the 22nd. Go out and see it. It's Emma Stone, Steve Carell. A cameo. Well, it's not even a cameo. There's like a small part, like a supporting part done by Sarah Silverman in this. Right. And I swear to God, I didn't even know until I was looking at the IMDb that Sarah Silverman was in it. She's like transformed totally. I didn't recognize her at all. Yeah. It's like, it's not very often that somebody that you recognize or know can go without being recognizable in the film. And I guess it's because I didn't know she was in it to begin with. I didn't go in looking for her, but it didn't even strike me. And of course, Elizabeth Shue plays Priscilla Riggs, the wife of tennis great Bobby Riggs, who is the antagonist in this film, where he is facing and challenging Billie Jean King, played by Emma Stone, in the Battle of the Sexes. It was an iconic moment in time for the women's revolution, if you will, the women's movement in the early 70s. And it led to women in sports being treated equally to men, at least in terms of pay. And Elizabeth, I got chills during that interview. I hope the listeners at home also responded really well. Elizabeth is amazing. She looked gorgeous at the premiere. And look for that interview, as well as our Ross Matthews interview, to be going up on HuffPost sooner rather than later.
Let's help people go ahead and want to plagiarize that, too.
Oh, my God, yes. So, did we talk about that on the last episode?
I don't think we did.
Well, you guys, our recent episode, which featured bisexual professional wrestler Anthony Bowens, went up on Huffington Post, Queer Voices. I wrote up an article on it. And then all of a sudden, one after another, quote-unquote, news sites around the world started rerunning the article. But they didn't actually take time to listen to the interview and write their own story. Basically, they used all of the quotes that I used in my story, including the structural quality of the article, meaning it starts the same way and ends the same way, and has mostly the same middle points, basically plagiarizing my article. And while I haven't said it publicly anywhere else, the biggest offender was Logo TV's website, New Now Next. The writer there basically almost verbatim stole the article from me and posted it. And the only reason I didn't fucking go completely apeshit and clock the bitch for it is that it got us some good traffic. It got us some good traffic to the web, to our podcast. It drew attention to a great story, but if you are a fucking journalist, you should have some dignity.
Yeah,
you
know, girl, what I mean? Right. Where's your dignity at, girl, as a writer?
I mean, one of the things that they teach you, if you actually educate yourself as a journalist, the first thing that they pound into your head is about journalistic ethics and integrity. And that should be something that I think should not have to be taught, but obviously it needs to be taught. Right. It doesn't matter what industry you're in. If you pass somebody else's work off as your own and don't clarify that it's somebody else's, you are a shady motherfucker.
Shady.
Right. So one of the sites that did us great justice is Instinct Magazine. Thank you, Instinct Magazine, for picking up our article, picking up coverage of our interview, citing us. They didn't mention me as the writer of the article, and I'm fine with that. But what they did say is that he told us as a podcast, and then they would cite these things. But they also did it kind of almost like a Q&A type of thing. Like, the podcast asked this, and then they would give the quote. The other journalist wrote the article almost exactly the way I did. It wasn't a Q&A situation. I wrote it as an expository article, meaning it reads like a story. And I quoted things. And you guys, this is how I know. Not only did he not listen to the podcast, but he stole the shit directly from me, is because as a journalist and as the person who conducted the interview, I have the ability to take a little bit of leeway, meaning that I'll take different pieces of quotes from different areas of our interview and run them together to make the story work the right way. I'm not editing it to change the context, but I'm editing like something that he said 4 minutes before and putting it next to something that comes later.
Right.
And this dude did exactly that. He stole them, the quotes. And sometimes you change, like you'll change a little word or you'll drop, in my case, I'll drop out if somebody says, or pauses or whatever. All of that stolen directly from me. Shady fucking lady. Shady lady, bitch. So anyway, that podcast got national and international recognition. And Anthony Bowens, the person who we interviewed, said it was the most acknowledgement and recognition that he has gotten on his story of coming out overall. So he was very excited that we featured That's him cool. and so happy. But he was also a little unhappy about how some of the sites stole the article and then twisted the content to be for the headline purposes. Like, one place said something like that bisexual wrestler Anthony Bowens discusses his arousal during, or whatever. That was like the headline.
Oh, girl, clickbait.
It was clickbait. And it was talking about how, as a bisexual, he finds sexual arousal from both genders,
right,
which is what qualifies him and makes him identify as bisexual. Not that he gets aroused by whatever during his matches. It kind of felt nasty and yucky.
The nerve.
It was pretty gross. So,
well, this is off topic, but
nothing's off topic here, bitch.
Have you heard? I'm sure. I mean, if you haven't heard, you've been living under a rock. The new cosmetic line by Rihanna, Fenty.
I've heard of Fenty, yes.
Oh my god, girl! So I picked up my foundation of my color yesterday. Thankfully, because they pretty much ran out of everything. It's completely sold out, pretty much. Well, not completely. If I picked up a cup, So anyway, I just have to say this is probably the best foundation I've ever worn in my life.
Oh,
like I love it. It takes to makeup wonderfully. I feel like I'm putting on a fucking Instagram filter when I add makeup to it. It's so nice. I think because I wear so much makeup, though, you don't get to see the best quality of the foundation.
Okay.
So, like, the less makeup you wear, the more...
The
better the quality of the foundation you'll get to see. But it's wonderful. I definitely recommend it. It's 100% cruelty-free. Rihanna, better go.
So... I also have seen that people have been pushing for Rihanna to hire that transgender model who was released by, I don't remember what company that she was released from. They released her for, I'm trying to remember what the thing was. Hold on, you guys. I'm going to pause this. I'm going to come back once I get the information. Okay, we're back. I looked it up. Her name is Monroe Bergdorf. She was L'Oreal's first ever transgender model, and she was fired by L'Oreal after white people accused her of... Oh, no. She said she was fired from L'Oreal because she described all white people as racist in a Facebook post. She's 29, reportedly landed a contract just days ago as one of five ambassadors for L'Oreal's True Match diversity campaign, launching a new range of foundations. But in a now-deleted Facebook post, which Bergdorf said she wrote weeks ago, brought an end to the relationship. In her post, she said, Honestly, I don't have energy to talk about the racial violence of white people anymore. Yes, all white people, she went on, because most of y'all don't even realize or refuse to acknowledge that your existence, privilege, and success as a race is built on the backs, bloods, and deaths of people of color. By the use of an OU in this, she might not be American. Your entire existence is drenched in racism, from microaggression to terrorism. You guys built the blueprint for this shit. Come see me when you realize that racism isn't learned, it's inherited and consciously or unconsciously passed down through privilege. Once white people begin to admit their race is the most violent and oppressive force of nature on earth, then we can talk. Until then, stay acting shocked about how the world continues to stay fucked at the hands of your ancestors and your heads that remain buried in the sand with hands over your ears.
Well, I want to see what she looks like.
After the post surfaced, hold on, I'll show you in a second. It says, after the post surfaced, L'Oreal condemned Bergdorf's comments and announced that she has been sacked. In a statement on Twitter, it said, L'Oreal champions diversity. Comments by Monroe Bergdorf are at odds with our values, and so we have decided to end our partnership with her. Bergdorf responded to a request for comment from The Sun, which is, this is a British-based thing. She said that the Facebook post was a direct response to the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, America, last month. This rant was a direct response to the violence of white supremacists in Charlottesville. It was not written this week, the model told The Sun. When I stated that all white people are racist, I was addressing the fact that Western society as a whole is a system rooted in white supremacy, designed to benefit, prioritize, and protect white people before anyone of any other race. Unknowingly, white people are socialized to be racist from birth onwards. It's not something genetic. No one is born racist. She went on, the irony of all this is that L'Oreal Paris invited me to be part of the beauty campaign that stands for diversity. The fact that up until very recently, there has been next to no mainstream brand offering makeup for black women and ethnic minorities is in itself due to racism within the industry. Bergdorf describes herself as an activist on Instagram and met politicians, including Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn and London Mayor Sadiq Khan. This is her.
She's beautiful.
She is beautiful. She's very beautiful. But back to the original point, people have been urging Rihanna to hire her for her campaign. So that's something. I also, in other recent news, something that did happen this week that bears conversation is, did you read about the shooting death of the head of the Pride organization at a Georgia university? You didn't read about this?
I haven't heard about this.
Okay, so
what is this?
Look it up on your phone. Look for police shoot. It's in Georgia. While Pearl's looking this up, I'll give you guys a recap. I want Pearl to...
There's a lot of shit that always goes. Let me see.
Right. I want Pearl to, like, look this up, but I'm going to recap for you guys and her simultaneously, but I want her to have more details. Over the weekend or late last week, the head of the Pride organization at a Southern or a Georgia university was shot and killed by police in an action.
Three people?
No. Well, this person. That one.
Okay.
This incident happened on a college campus, and so what is making more headlines, even more so than this actual incident, is the fact that various places are deeming this situation.
Oh, is this the person who had, like, they thought this person had a knife or something?
And the person did have a knife.
I've heard this person didn't have a knife.
There's a video. There's a video, and it shows clearly that the person does have a knife.
I heard they had something, but it wasn't a knife.
Well, this is what's going on. The news is reporting variously, depending on which news source you're going to.
And he wasn't even a police officer. He was campus security or something.
Something to that effect. So the individual was reported for having a knife and a gun. The fact was that the person does not have a gun, but does appear to have a knife. And some sources are saying, like, the police murdered this individual. Others are saying that police were doing their job.
Yeah, but Schultz's knife was merely a multi-tool with no blade in sight, according to the family.
Okay, well, so that's all fine.
Yeah.
Like, so this is my take on it, you guys. In this incident, like, thankfully it was fully recorded, because either way, depending on which side you're on, I'm sure it provides you some argument. But during the course of this situation, the individual is acting both erratic and aggressively, and holding what appears, probably even to people who were closer than the video was taken, to be a knife. The police say, drop your weapon, not once, not twice, but probably close to 10 times, and you hear it over and over. And then the person sort of is acting so erratically, they're sort of like lurching. It's very like, very creepy, very zombie-esque, like lurching towards... And
yeah, it looks like the person was drunk.
And calls out repeatedly, shoot me, kill me, something like that. And the police officers say, we don't want to hurt you. Please drop the weapon. Nobody wants to hurt you. But point in time, the individual shouts out, kill me, and like lurches towards the police officers. And then after like multiple times of being told to put down the weapon, is shot. Okay, now this is the part that's crazy. The person must have a fucking very good aim because they shot the person directly in the heart. Killed him instantly. But kind of not surprising because everybody in the South, like so many people in the South have guns and it's like hunting and whatever. So they're probably a good shot. But a lot of media are saying that this person should have been subdued using tear gas or all of these
something
other...
Something and brought to a mental hospital.
All of these other things.
A mental facility.
And that's arguable. But the fact of the matter is, if the person is surrounded by police officers who are saying, like, we don't... I mean, this isn't an incident quite like some of the other situations which are undoubtedly police brutality gone completely wrong, right? Where somebody's, like, doing nothing and then all of a sudden it leads to somebody getting suffocated or killed or shot or some stupidity. This is a person who, for all intents and purposes, has what appears to be a weapon and the police are all but begging them, like, don't... We don't want to hurt you. Drop your weapon. Like, get on the ground, whatever. And the person yells out, shoot me, kill me. And while it is debatable whether or not some non-deadly force could have been used, they also had been reported that the individual might have a gun. They didn't have a gun that was obviously present. But there's so many things, like, at play here. And I honestly feel like if an individual is coming at you with what you think is a knife, like that some element of force should be used. I don't know that you should shoot them through the heart.
Right.
But the fact is, what was later revealed, that this person had clear and present suicidal ideations and tendencies, had left suicide notes in advance of this situation. And there is a psychological incident that is referred to as suicide by police, meaning that an individual wants to, like, self-harm but doesn't have the personal courage to do it, so they will incite a situation wherein the police will shoot them and kill them.
Huh.
So that's a real thing. I don't know. It's brought up a lot of conversation because I'm really torn. I feel like...
Well, I think... Coming from someone who works in the mental health industry, I feel like police themselves are really not trained to deal with mentally ill people. They're not. They're simply not.
They're not.
Let alone campus security. And secondly, what is campus security doing with a gun and not anything? Like, I think the security here in California, I don't think they're allowed to... The campus security, anyway, is not allowed to carry a gun. I think campus security out here, like, may carry, like, a club or something. Or maybe, like, a taser. But they don't have, like, guns. But I guess in, Georgia?
It was in Georgia.
I guess it's a different story because everybody's armed out there.
And also, one thing, I don't know this for a fact. Don't take this as fact. But one thing that did come to mind is that quite often, off-duty police officers will act as security in, you know, some places for extra money or whatever. And if you're a police officer, you have the right to... have a weapon on you or whatever.
Right.
And in Georgia, anybody can carry, as long as it's exposed, as far as I know, it's registered and exposed, you can carry a weapon. But, so, one of the things that came to my mind about this is we're in this era where the president is frequently talking about fake news, right?
Like, right.
So, and I'm beginning to, like, I'm not taking his side in any capacity, but I am becoming increasingly aware of scenarios that would be qualified as fake news, where people are taking things that are happening and taking them out of context or whatever. And it, like we were talking about earlier with the clickbait shit with Anthony Bowens, things are clickbait and then people start to cite that. And next thing you know, it's like, you know, fake news does exist. We just actually, this whole conversation leading up to this makes that kind of appropriate, because I was just talking about how journalists are, quote unquote, journalists are so fucking lazy, they'll steal my work.
Right.
And if,
word, almost word for word.
And what if my work that they're stealing from was that clickbait?
Exactly.
And next thing you know, something is being spread all around. And in this situation, there are people who are calling this like violent aggression by the police on a person. And some places are even saying that it's enhanced by the fact that this person is non-binary, queer.
Yeah.
Like doesn't identify as male or female, asked to be referred to as they and their mm-hmm. and whatever. So they're saying that this is being amplified by that. And then, you know, the situation is transpiring that some people are calling this a violent situation. Whereas, honest to God, with me, I think that, yes, it's possible that some kind of non-life-threatening situation could have been, you know, taking place here. Shoot the person in the arm, for example.
Or the leg, or anything.
Or whatever. But, you know, right. But this is the super fucked up part. Our society has advanced in a way that, let's say they had shot that person in the arm to, like, disarm them.
Right.
Then 6 months from now, that person's, like, suing them for, like, you ruined my arm. You know, and it's like, I think that when a situation transpires where you are confronted by a police officer or something like that, anybody, bitch, I don't give a fuck. I could have a plastic fork in my hand, and if somebody who's drawn a gun on me is telling me to put it down, you know that fork is hitting the ground ASAP, bitch. Not the fourth time, not the tenth time they tell me. First time. Like,
I would hope I would do so, but I'm one of those people that gets, I either freeze when something scary is going on, or, and like, I just can't move, or like, I flee. It's almost like...
Fight or flight.
Yeah, fight or flight. So, and I just hope I wouldn't be the type of person to freeze, because they would shoot me.
Well, I mean, this person...
I would get shot.
This person would have done better to freeze. They probably... Right. If the person would have frozen in place, they would have probably gone more that route of, like, pepper spray or
right.
something like that to disarm them. This person's, like, lurching. Watch the video. It's fucking creepy. Like Night of the Living Dead, like... staggering and like you know, kind of moving slow, and then all of a sudden like fat.
Oh,
it's like,
no.
I mean, my heart goes out to the individual's family, and I can completely understand why they're devastated for the loss of their child.
Right.
But at the same time, like, they also indicate in reports about, like, after the fact that this person's had suicidal ideations and tendencies. Well, honey, like, where were you? And like, put your child in an institution and get them some serious help. And like,
sometimes it's not that easy to get help for people that are mentally ill. And I can only imagine what it's like in Georgia to try to get help. Well, I mean, we're a big city,
right?
In San Francisco here, you know, and we still don't have enough services for a lot of these people. A lot of these people go into the hospital and come out just to go back in.
Right.
I can't even imagine what it's like in Georgia for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's very difficult. I'm sure it's a totally different environment.
Yeah.
But the reality is that if you are aware that your...
How old is this person?
22, I believe. If
yeah.
you're aware that your child has the capacity to be of...
But at 22, you legally
right.
cannot do anything.
But if a person... I don't know about in Georgia. Again, we're talking about Georgia, United States, you guys. And I know a lot of our listenership is outside of the United States. Georgia, United States, is very southern. It has a very different perspective on
right.
a lot of things than places like major metropolitan areas here in San Francisco or New York or Los Angeles. But
mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, if you live most places and a person is presenting a clear and present danger to themselves or others, there are options that you can have that person like
yeah.
locked up for their own safety so that they can get help or psychological evaluation.
But you know what the thing is, like, until they are violent to themselves or someone else, you can't say this person needs help. And that person, if they're not getting other services to help with whatever diagnosis they're facing.
Absolutely.
It makes it really difficult coming from a parent.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I saw, I don't remember
That just sucks because you're waiting for catastrophe.
Yeah. One of the things that, like I said, that made me want to like bring this topic to conversation here is that one of the heads of a national or possibly international transgender organization tweeted about this yesterday, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And in her tweet, she indicated that this was like the murder, like the institutionalized murder of a transgender individual. And I just think that that is, I felt like that is really making this situation way less than it really is. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. If you want to say that less force could have been used in bringing this individual kind of like...
Completely.
Let's argue that. But I think that when you make a headline or a tweet that says like transgender person killed by cops, like it represents it in a complete... Like that brings to my mind a situation like Trayvon Martin or something where somebody's sort of like kind of not doing anything and all of a sudden becomes a... This person was clearly... was presenting a danger to people. And the degree of danger is open for discussion, but just, I would say the flip side for the police is exactly what Pearl was just saying. Like, you're waiting for something catastrophic to happen. Do we wait until you, like, stab one of us, or or do we take action in the moments before? Mm-hmm. And if you've got some kind of what appears to be a weapon in your hand, am I supposed to wait to find out if it's going to, like, kill me? Or am I supposed to...
I think at that point, though, the campus security, because they weren't cops, campus security was legally able to bring that person to a psych institute or a psych unit.
Which I'm sure would have happened had the person allowed themselves to be subdued.
I don't believe killing the person was the answer.
I don't think that... I don't necessarily think...
the only way to get out of that situation.
I do think that police officers, when they feel in imminent danger, are allowed to draw their weapon. And if they feel that their safety is threatened, they're allowed to use their weapon. So they had drawn the weapon based on the fact that this person had in the hands of the individual they're confronting was what appeared to be a weapon. They repeatedly asked. And so I'm not saying that deadly force was the only option, but I am saying that, like, if you start to, if our society becomes overly sensitive to the fact that really shitty things happen that are unprovoked, that they are not allowed to act when something is obviously, like, a little bit farther, more extreme, then where do you stop? Because it's like, well... I'm sorry. Like, if I saw somebody that looked crazy and out of their mind lunging at me with something, I'm going to react.
Sure. But you know what? You are not a trained police officer or, you know, security person with a weapon that you should be trained in using. That's not your job.
Right. But again, I would just...
Of course.
I would just call into question, like... I just think it's unfortunate because I do think that... In situations like this, where there's a lot of gray area, it's not quite as cut and dry as some of these other situations, where there's a lot of gray area, it just fuels the fire by people who... I think of it in the same way as when people who have, like, a really internalized drive to be racist find something really horrific to, like, as fuel to their fire. When somebody acts a fucking fool and then, like, they use that as support. Or somebody who's, like... really homophobic sees something that, then again, I guess I shouldn't really say anything because I'm a walking, talking stereotype of what means to be the faggotiest of faggots. So whatever. All right, you guys, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more Party Call Radio right after this. Swiss Navy Premium Personal Lubricants carries lubrication for all of your personal lubrication needs. Swiss Navy Premium Lubricant runs the gamut from water and silicone-based lubricants to anal creams, masturbation creams, and much, much more. Swiss Navy Premium Personal Lubricants are available at fine retailers near you. Party Foul Radio is proud to be sponsored by Swiss Navy Premium Personal Lubricants. All right, everybody, we are back with more Party Foul Radio. I'm Poet Omar.
And I'm Pearl Tease.
And you out there who listen know that I always try to bring on some of the most fabulous people in one of my most passion projects, professional wrestling. And our next guest
is known as being the perfect 10, girl.
She is the perfect 10. And I lived for her when I was growing up. Pearl, I had outside my bedroom door an entire hallway of all these, like, big glossy photos from wrestling magazines when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
And I specifically recall numerous. I had a whole section dedicated to Baby Doll, the perfect 10. So please welcome one of my icons from the 80s, Miss Baby Doll, Nicola Robertson. Hi, how are you, Baby Doll?
I'm very well, thank you. This is definitely an honor. This is so cool. Thank you.
Well, I was so excited when you agreed to join us because Twitter is an amazing thing that allows us to reach out and connect with people who have inspired us throughout our lives, and you definitely were one of those. And I was surprised, honestly, that you were open to being with us.
Well, why wouldn't I be? This is, like, so cool. I mean, I like meeting a lot of different people, and I like knowing a lot about a lot. So it's so cool, and it's really neat because I don't know who had more of a following through the gay community, whether it was me or my ex-husband, Sam Houston, because something about Sam's red trunks just turned guys on to no end, and I still hear it. And then it's really cool to hear from guys that took inspiration from myself, because, I mean, I'm not like the typical girl. I'm, like, almost 6 foot tall and, you know, usually about 200, 210, and I'm a big girl, and it was just how I carried myself was just an inspiration to a lot of people. And at the time, I never knew it. But now hearing back from everybody, it's very, very flattering. And it's so appreciative.
Well, as I tweeted to you, I think that if you were a fan of wrestling in the 80s, there was either two perspectives among men. That either they wanted to sleep with you, or in my case, they wanted to be you.
Right.
So I got to grow up and live that dream. I definitely take full inspiration in my drag persona from you.
Well, great. Thank you. That's really cool. It really is. And one of the best compliments I think I ever received was, I worked for Walmart for like 13 years. I did overnight stocking, and I kind of figured that they paid me to work out. And I had a little friend there, his name was Cody, and he was very kind of manic depressive. He was either really, really happy, or he was just down in the dumps, and it was so hard to, like, talk to him and just be a person without being like I was going to offend him, without really even saying anything. So I would bake him stuff, and it was like a peace offering, you know, like, here, I'm really cool, and you can like me, and I'd bake him cookies and soup and different things like that. And he was, and one day he says, "Why can't you be a gay man?" And I was like, "I'm just not, baby. I'm just not." Because it was just everything that about me he just loved, except for I was a female. And it was like there was no distinction one or the other. And then our friendship grew throughout. We're still friends now. And whenever I was getting ready to come up here to Hickory, up on the north side of Hickory in North Carolina, he said that I was a white witch, that no matter how bad he felt, if he came and talked to me, he knew that things were going to get better. And that was just so cool that, you know, just my little part and just talking to someone and baking them cookies or soup could make someone's life a little bit better.
Well, I definitely think that the relationship that you developed with him was the opposite of what so many, because I know countless women who have said to their gay best friend, "Oh, why can't you just be straight?" Like, you know, right. I mean, it's the same thing because they're like, you make me feel good.
Well,
you treat me well.
There's no changing who we are. We are who we are.
Absolutely.
And God bless us if we can find someone that will love us for who we are without putting up a big facade and all, just love you for who you are and just be a human being and be nice to each other.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Now, you mentioned your ex-husband, Sam Houston, and that means that for many years, you were the sister-in-law of probably my favorite wrestler of all time, Jake the Snake Roberts. So,
yes.
What was that like? What is that like, knowing Jake? And
well, Jake and I started out, like, way before. Jake and I actually started working in Dallas, the exact same time. Jake actually held the door open for me when we started doing our first TV for World Class Championship Wrestling. He had just got married to Cheryl, and we hung out for like the first 2 weeks. He stayed with me in my hotel, and we traveled, and because I figured that he was safe since he had just gotten married, and you know, it would be like temptation or dating one of the boys or anything like this. It would be business. And we just struck up like a really close friendship throughout the time. We're like riding up and down the roads and talking, and then with his last name being Roberts, and you know, his wrestling name Roberts, and then my real name being Roberts. And I found out that he actually got his name from my dad. He was working up in Detroit for the Sheik, and the Sheik was using the snake gimmick down in Texas with my dad, and it was just over huge. And he had gone up there and was talking in the dressing room about what a cool promoter my dad was and how he had a snake, and the girl would, you know, bring the snake down for him, and he could do his fire gimmick and the rug and the whole thing, and was talking. And so Jake's over the corner, and he's going, Jake the Snake Roberts. So he actually got the name Roberts from my dad, not knowing that 10 years later we would meet down the road. And then it was about a year later, I was actually kind of messing around with one of the guys, and he was married, and I got a phone call from Jake. I was in Ocean City, Maryland, and he was just like, you're better than that, and why don't you see my brother, and my brother's an all right guy, and he'll treat you all right, and you just need to be with a better guy that's who you're messing with. So about a month after that, we did the 30-day deal with Dusty, and Sam actually drove me away from matches. And because Dusty had the two-seater Mercedes and Magnum had the two-seater Porsche, there wasn't room for me, so I got to ride around with Sam. And we hit it off, and we actually got married a year from the time that our first kiss.
Oh, oh my wow. God.
Kind of turned around, and then I was married to Sam until 1992, and we had two daughters, and Jake and I still talk on the road every once in a while, and I never talk to my ex-husband, so actually the friendship with Jake outlasted my marriage.
Wow.
Well, you know what? Whenever I tell people that Jake the Snake is probably my favorite wrestler of all time, they automatically assume that I knew him exclusively from WWF and when he had the snake and everything. I was a fan. Of course, I grew up in the Houston and Texas area where you start, you know, in that whole circuit of Texas where you got your start. And I was a fan of him when he wrestled in those horrible, like, burgundy wrestling.
The karate pants.
Yeah, the karate pants. I always thought they were, like, scrubs from a hospital, but that's how I knew
him. They were actually, like, karate pants.
So,
oh my goodness.
That's when I knew. And
they were horrible. And did you know that for a while, I actually made Jake's tights for him when he was in WWE until Vince started taking over all the costuming for the guys. I actually made tights for Jake for a little over a year.
Wow. You're multi-talented, too.
All right.
Yes, I am. You can't find what you want on the shelf, so you have to make it yourself.
Right.
That's right. Especially when you're a woman of a certain size.
Exactly. Because I am my own personal seamstress, believe me.
So before him, was it, speaking of being like a woman of a certain size, was it hard for you to date being a woman into wrestling and so tall?
Oh, yes. It's because the high school that I went to, it was maybe 40% Mexican American. So here I am like head and shoulders above like everybody. And I wore like the 3-inch Amalari heels. So that legitimately put me at 6'2".
Oh my goodness.
No, I like being tall. I can't hide. And then I've got like blonde hair, and I bleach my hair, so I stand out anyway. And then you get either the big meathead guys, or it just didn't work out. And that's why, like, Sam and I worked out really well, because he's like 6'3" and tall and lanky, and it worked out really well. But dating was not fun, because you'd meet a guy and you'd be sitting down and you'd be talking and everything, and then you go to stand up and you keep standing up and you keep standing up, and I'm like, yeah, I'm really this tall.
Yeah. I It's funny because I'm imagining your experience there, because I remember when I was in drag recently in Asia, and not to like stereotype, but they're not as tall as Americans necessarily, or at least not as tall as this American in that part of Asia. And I walked through the room and literally almost every single person didn't even come to my shoulders. And I felt it was kind of fierce because you got a great view, but it was kind of also awkward. You're thinking to yourself like, wow, like
it's kind of weird. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm absurdly tall here. So.
Well, and then you don't want to be like clunky, and then you want to be graceful, and it's hard to be like my size and be like light on your feet and like, yeah, because I'm like the biggest clutch ever. So it's like, yeah, I'm a giant donkey. And it's like, oh, well, it's okay. I'll be all right.
You were telling me.
What are you going to do? You know, if you've got a size 12 feet and, you know, like probably about a 44-inch butt and you know, like weigh 210, it's not hard. It's hard to be grateful. It really is.
You were telling me in our private conversations that because of your physical stature, being a tall, like strong-built woman, that in many times in the 80s, people actually thought, because you would get in the ring and wrestle with men and all this stuff, that you were actually a man.
Oh, there were signs in the audience that Baby Doll is really a man, and would look at you. It was they were just trying to be mean. But even like whenever I went to go buy shoes, it was, you know, you'd go and you'd be looking and you'd get the sideways look of like, is she a girl or is she a guy? Or
trust me, I know that feeling.
You know, and then I had kind of like the punky hair, you know, like the real short spiked hair. And at one time I had it shaved on one side and it was pink, and that was 30 years ago, and hardly ever anybody did it that way. And now it's very common, but back then to have like half your head shaved and pink hair and looking for size 12 shoes, it was kind of a questionable situation.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine like, I remember that era of your career that was so early on in it. And then when you, because you were, for the listeners out there, she was at that time very punk rock and wore leather and black spandex and like spikes and stuff. It was very cool. But then when you jumped over from that organization into like the mainstream professional wrestling that was broadcasting on TBS at that time around the world and across the country, you got this transformation where you became sort of like a glamour puss a little bit with, you know.
Come on, embrace some femininity.
Like,
I was with Kelly for a while, and it was kind of like the bodyguard role, like what I had with Gino. But then whenever I went with Dusty, then it kind of softened up a little bit, because then I could be a little bit more feminine. And it was fun because I got to wear something new every week, and they pretty much let me wear whatever I wanted to. I never once had anyone. Well, I did have Dusty tell me one time we were getting ready to do posters that he wanted me to look like the women on Dynasty.
Good afternoon, Crystal. What are you doing here, Alexis? No one gave you permission to come into this house.
I don't need permission, Crystal.
And I did the red dress with the ruffles and the black and red boa. That was my idea of Dynasty. And then, but anything else, it was, we didn't have stairs that went up to the ring like what the girls get to use now. I actually had to like jump in the ring every night at least once, if not twice, if we won. And then if there was any rough and tumbling, then I had to think, and I didn't want like everybody to see my ass. So black spandex was definitely my friend. And then with a tux jacket, that to me, it always made me look like really statuesque and down to business. And then I was more of a valet than a manager.
Right.
So it kind of all tied into that. And then I got a lot of compliments if you wore like just a bow tie and a low neckline. That got a lot of compliments. And back then, there wasn't the computers and there wasn't any way to really kind of look back at what you did. We would try and set our tapes, you know, like our VHS tapes to tape our shows, but then if the electricity went off or if you didn't know how to set your VCR, then it got screwed up and you couldn't see what you looked like. And it was just mainly like magazines, like what you said. I'd rush into this convenience store and buy up all the magazines, hoping I was in some of them so I could see what look I liked the most and then capitalize on it. I also had a seamstress, Dorothy Edwards, that made a lot of my clothes, you know, because that way I could go pick out material and she would make me jackets or long shirts or whatever, and then that would be my own look. But when you think that I had two TVs that I had to do on Tuesdays, I had promos on Wednesday morning, and then I had 3 hours, which would be two different segments of TBS TV tapings on Saturday, and you wanted to have something new and fresh, and you didn't want to be wearing, like, the same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
So it was fun.
So
I spent a lot of money, so, yeah, it was fun.
So what was it like trying to get into the WWF?
It was hard. I had trained for the summer at Nelson Royal. My sister-in-law, Rockin' Robin, and I worked out for like a whole summer up at Nelson's camp, learning how to wrestle and take bumps, because they weren't really doing like the valet, because they already had Elizabeth. And so there was no way anyone was going to take over that role. But you could go in as a girl wrestler because they had the Glamour Girls. They had Lalani Kai and Judy Martin. They had Wendy Richter. They had Lula, Velvet McIntyre. They had quite a few girls that they were using at the time. But with my size, it just didn't look right. I mean, it's a little bit taller than China. But then I'm glad to go the route of China because they really made her a masculine. And I didn't want to do that because in my own way, I might be a big girl, but I'm still very feminine.
Right.
And I didn't want to, I'm glad I didn't go the route that, like, what China did just to be famous.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You have had the tremendous opportunity to work with the biggest names in the professional wrestling industry. Some of them, even the biggest names today. You know, we're talking Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Tully Blanchard.
Larry Zbysko, Gino Hernandez, Jay, Chris Adams. Yeah, I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time and to really work with, you know, the top guys. Even today, when you name off the names, everybody knows. I was very, very fortunate.
What was it like to work? I mean, by the way, just letting you know that I'm going to be starting my own podcast aside from this one, where we get to talk really detailed things about wrestling just for wrestling fans. But what was it like getting to work at the early stages of something like the Four Horsemen, which is one of the most iconic storylines in history of wrestling?
I don't know how to describe it. The first year that I worked, like Kelly and I worked together, we had 15 days off the whole year. There was no holidays, there was no weekends. On Saturday, or like on Sundays, a lot of the days, it was double shot. On Tuesdays, Tully wrestled a lot of times twice because it was TV. On Saturday, it was like we wrestled twice because it was TV on TBS. But to think that out of the whole year, you had 15 days off, and just to have that whole buildup of like a year and a half of working with him, because I started in January of 85, and the Horsemen were really kind of born like July of 86. And it all kind of came about because it happened in Philadelphia. Philadelphia was really a heel town, and they would dress up on the front row like the Four Horsemen. They would have like the suits and the ties, and they'd be holding up the four fingers. And whenever the guys saw that, they were like, wow, this is really going to go over. And it's one thing to be popular in Charlotte and to go through the airport and have, you know, the stewards and the porters all yelling like, woo, and Flair and Dusty and knowing everybody. And then whenever you're going to, like, Philadelphia and Chicago and Baltimore and all, like, the bigger towns, and then they start knowing you, and they start knowing you more and more and more. It was, to say it was a tidal wave would be an underestimate. I can't describe it. It's just, you go from like a handful of people knowing you this week to like maybe 50 more knowing you the next month, and like 150 the following month. And it just really grew because the product that we had and the guys were great, and how much believability, because, you know, you had like the WWF, it was WWF at the time. That was wrestling, it was fine. But when they had Crockett came to town, even though it was wrestling, they believed our product. They believed what we were doing was real. And it was cool. It was and then to be like the only girl at the time traveling with them and having the respect of that was awesome. And even today, it's really cool to be around the guys that still have that respect. Like Flair yelling at me across the room, "Gave it on!" And just, I don't know how to describe it. It's like I'm 12 years old here.
Well, I am so glad that you joined us for this podcast. And when I launch my new one, All About Wrestling, you'll come back and talk to me at great length, yes?
If you'd like for me to, I would love to.
Oh, my God, of course.
I might hook you up with some other guys and let them know that you're cool and that you give them a good interview.
Oh, I would love that. That's amazing.
So sweet.
So how can people follow you on social media?
Really through my Twitter. I'm under Nicola Roberts. I did have Facebook, but my husband didn't like the popularity. And so if I could get rid of my Facebook, he gave me goats and chickens instead. So I don't have a Facebook, but I do have Twitter. And then they can always hit you up, and then you can point them in my direction also.
Absolutely.
That'd be cool.
That's absolutely correct. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate all that you've done to contribute to who I am today. And I'm so glad.
And then if I ever get to do a show and we're ever close by, you have to do my makeup.
Oh my God. If anyone ever did my makeup,
you would be the first one that I would ever do my makeup.
Oh, I love that. That's life goals right there, you guys. Thank you, Nicola.
Pinky promise, you know, pinky promise.
Yes, absolutely, pinky promise.
Okay, all right. And that's the deal, because I swear to God, no one has ever done my makeup, because I've never had the luxury of doing that. I've always had to do it myself. But I've seen your pictures and stuff, and I was just like, I have to have her do my makeup. Have to.
Aw, thank you.
Whew. And then we can trade off shoes, because I bet you we're pretty close to the same size.
Yes, I think so, too.
Probably.
All right. Thank
awesome. This has been so cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, you guys.
Oh, girl. She's in for one.
Pearl's, like, over here gagged. Whatever.
Gagged, girl. Like, I can't even wait.
Well, she and I are almost the same physical size, so I think that I could... Could you imagine?
I don't think it would be so fierce. I don't think she knows what she's getting herself into.
Bitch, she's seen the pictures. I'm stunning. Hello.
Okay.
Anyway, you guys, that was Nicola Roberts. You can follow her at N-I-C-K-L-A.
Roberts
on Twitter. And she is Baby Doll, the Perfect 10. She was the manager for Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Tully Blanchard. These are icons of the professional wrestling industry. And she is one of the people that I always just was in awe of as a child, loving professional wrestling. We are going to take a quick break, and we will back... why even take a break? Let's just call it a quit here, you guys.
Well, don't forget to follow us both on Twitter, like I said, and Facebook.
Yes.
Party Foul Radio. And don't forget to check out our sponsors.
Right. And we are so grateful for all of them. We're grateful for you guys tuning in to listen to. We're number 7 in the Podomatic Talk world, girls.
Top 10, girl.
All right, you guys. For this episode, episode 84, I'm Poya Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl T.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. It's so fun. It's so fun. She's the one.